One in every 16 children in Illinois has a parent in prison. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Today on the 21st, we'll hear from a Chicago 16-year-old whose mother has been behind bars for the past 14 years.
Like, we was overexcited, and we went in the bathroom, we got our clothes together, we were rushing to get outside to the just to go see her, and we made it to the bus, and we were happy, we were on our way there, and then when we made it there,
we found out she was in solitary,
and they said, we're sorry, but no, you can't see her.
How much help are these families getting, especially given the current budget situation? We know $600 million will soon start flowing to state colleges and universities. Western Illinois University President Jack Thomas joins us to talk about what that money means for his campus. And the future of nuclear fusion, what Illinois researchers are working on. That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. The latest news is next. I'm Nyla Boodoo, and this is the 21st. Governor Bruce Rauner has just signed into law a bill that will send $600 million in much-needed cash to our state university system. Later in the hour, we'll talk with the president of Western Illinois University. But first...
Well, like, one visit, we didn't actually get a chance to even go inside. Like, we had to wait outside up in a bus. We found out she was in solitary, and they said, we're sorry, but no, you can't see her. And I asked the lady, and then I was like, what is solitary? And then she said, you wouldn't want to know, like it was a joke or something. So, I mean, we wasn't able to see her.
That was Melvina, her mother serving time in an Illinois correctional facility. We're going to hear from her in a few minutes. There are 186,000 children like Melvina in Illinois who have a parent behind bars. That's the sixth highest rate in the country, according to a new report out today by the Annie E. Casey Foundation. Today on the 21st, we're going to hear stories from formerly incarcerated parents, their children, and the people who are taking care of them. We'll also talk about what resources exist for children like Melvina and how much of what was there has been affected by the ongoing state budget impasse, which has forced drastic cuts at social service agencies throughout the state. We're going to start with the perspective of a parent who was once incarcerated. Siobhan is from the Chicago area. She asked that we not use her last name. Hi, Siobhan. Welcome to the 21st.
Hi, thank you.
Now, you pled guilty to the crime of theft by deception in 2010. At the time, your children were, you have three kids, and at the time they were 2, 5, and 10. Siobhan, what did you think was going to happen to your children when you left Chicago and you were imprisoned in Decatur?
My understanding with the papers and orders from the courts that were put into play time was that I would have phone calls with my children. I would be able to write them. They would be able to write me back. And also that my parents would be able to have visitations with them and bring them to see me.
And instead, what happened?
Basically, as soon as I was taken into custody and tried to call, I was blocked from calling my ex-husband's house where the children were residing, and I had no further contact at that point.
And then, so you had about a year where you didn't have contact with your kids. How did you manage while you were behind bars to get into contact with them?
I tried every possible avenue. I wrote letters to them once a week, not knowing if they were getting them or not getting them. I tried calling continually, but the number was blocked. I tried reaching the attorney I had at the time to let them know that I was not being allowed to have contact with them, and I got nowhere with that avenue either.
And then once you, so would you say that once you were behind bars, did you feel like you lost all of your parental rights?
I lost everything. There was nobody there to help me, nobody there to guide me. I had nothing that I could do.
Mm-hmm. We're speaking with Siobhan, and I want to bring in someone else into this conversation. It's the person who introduces to Siobhan. That's Alexis Manfield. She's a supervising attorney with CLAIM. That's Chicago Legal Advocacy for Incarcerated Mothers. They're based at Cabrini Green Legal Aid. Alexis, thanks for joining us on the 21st as well.
Thank you so much for having me.
Siobhan, let me just ask you one quick question before I go back to Alexis. So when you said that your calls were being blocked, was that your ex-husband who was blocking the calls or was that the prison?
No, that was the ex-husband. Once you try to call a number from the prison phone, they have the option to refuse the call and block it. And once that's done, every time you call that number, it'll just tell you that number, you're blocked from calling that number.
Alexis, how common are stories like Siobhan's?
Unfortunately, they're not uncommon. Frequently happens that when a mother's incarcerated, she loses contact with her children, either because somebody doesn't want her to speak to the kids or more commonly because they don't have the financial means to be able to make that happen. Phone calls are incredibly expensive when you're calling from prison. And families that are already stretched because they're taking care of additional children often don't have the money for those calls and often don't have the money for those visits, which can run hundreds and hundreds of dollars.
Mm-hmm. And can you make clear to us, Alexis, to our audience, when a parent is incarcerated, do you lose parental rights? What is the legal stance of what happens once a parent is imprisoned?
No, you are not supposed to lose parental rights when you are incarcerated. No, when we think about the criminal legal system and somebody taking a plea on a case, they don't include as part of that plea when they include the sentence of how long you're going to serve or what type of probation, that you're also going to lose access to your children and also that your children are going to lose access to you. Unfortunately, sometimes that is what happens. So while you don't lose your parental rights and you're supposed to be able to maintain that contact, it's just incredibly difficult with all of the obstacles in the way. And just like parents don't lose their parental rights, children are not supposed to lose their rights to their parents. They're not supposed to be penalized when their parents are sentenced. Unfortunately, children often are, and that bond is often interrupted.
Alexis, your title says Chicago Legal Aid, the title of your organization, but in fact, you help women all over the state. Why is that?
We do. We worked with women in about 70 different counties across Illinois last year. And each year we work with women in counties across the state. That's for a number of reasons. One being that there are not many legal resources for women who are incarcerated. Most legal aides across the state receive something called LSC funding. And when a legal aid, such as Prairie State or Land of Lincoln or Legal Assistance Foundation, gets that type of funding, they are barred by law from helping anyone who's incarcerated, which means they can't help them with visitation or establishing a guardianship for their children to make sure they're somewhere safe. And so that's one of the main reasons that we help across the state, but also because incarceration affects women from everywhere. With the very strict laws regarding meth and heroin, there are women from basically every county in Illinois who've been sentenced to prison.
And oftentimes, obviously, there are prisons all across the state, but it's not. How often is it that the prison is close to where the family is?
Well, it really depends. But for women, it's pretty rare because there are only two women's facilities, main women's facilities in the Illinois Department of Corrections. For men, because they represent about 90% of those who are incarcerated in Illinois, there are more facilities, but a facility can be 5-6 hours away. From Chicago, the two women's facilities are both over 3 hours away from Chicago.
Siobhan, how did you hear about CLAIM? How did you manage to get a hold of Alexis?
They were coming to Decatur, which is the prison I was in, and there, as with every program that comes, there's a sign-up sheet, and they choose so many women from each unit to attend, and I was one of the ones chosen to attend and listen to their presentation on the services that they offer to help incarcerated women regain the relationships with their children.
How did you feel when you realized that these services might be available to you?
For the first time in a year, I felt a little bit of hope.
And so that was a year into your sentence. You ended up serving about 18 months. At what point what did you have to do to work with Alexis to be able to reestablish contact with your kids?
I was lucky enough to be chosen as one of the women that they would take on to help with being able to get back in touch with my children. And at that point, she had helped me released the attorney that was supposed to be helping me who wasn't, and was able to go ahead and get a court date to go before a judge on my behalf in order to establish some sort of guideline where I would be able to start having contact again with my children.
And when were you able to do that?
It was a little bit over, I would say, 13 months into my sentence. I had my first phone call with my kids.
And when were you able to first see them?
I was, Alexis went back into court and was granted permission to have my mom and dad bring my two boys down to see me. And that was just before Mother's Day in 2013.
Alexis, I wonder if I could step in and just ask you about, as Siobhan is sharing her story, what your caseload is like, and if there are women that you all would like to help but are not able to because of the resources that your organization has.
Absolutely. There are about 2,700 women in the Illinois Department of Corrections system at any given time. And we're a small office. We're part of Cabrini-Green Legal Aid, but we're definitely limited in what we can do. And so out of those 2,700 women, about 82% of them are mothers. And 70% of those women were the primary caregivers of their children before incarceration, meaning that those children really are suffering from not being able to be in contact with their moms or to have that strong bond. And so, yes, we would love to be able to do more, but our caseload is generally about, we teach about 1,000 women a year about family law, and we meet with about 350 individually.
Siobhan, what was it like that moment when you were first able to see your sons again? At that point, it probably had been, it had been over a year since you had seen them.
It still makes me cry when I think about it. They had just changed so much, and it was just, it's like when you have a child and you see them for the first time, and you just hug them and you don't want to let them go. It was just overwhelming.
Yeah. Now, that was a couple of years ago. How are your kids doing today?
They're doing really well today. It's been a long road. There's been a lot of intensive therapy involved with it. They're all real active in sports. They are, all three of them are high honor roll students. They're very, very good, respectful children.
One thing I wanted to ask you about, Siobhan, Alexis mentioned that a lot of women who have been imprisoned are the primary caregivers and breadwinners, I imagine, also for their family. Did you have trouble finding a job once you got out of prison?
It took me almost 2 years to find a job. It's just, I had an ex on my back, and that was who I was as a person all of a sudden. Nobody took into account, you know, I came from an upper-class family in an upscale neighborhood. I had made a mistake. I admitted to my mistake. I served my time for that mistake. And yet, even to this day, I work a full-time job. I work a part-time job. And I also do my own cleaning service, cleaning houses, just to try to make ends meet to keep my children and myself with a roof over our head and food on the table. It's not been an easy road.
Siobhan, what would you say to people? I imagine there are people who are listening who may think, well, maybe she should have thought about her kids when she was committing this crime. And I mean, I wonder what you would say to someone who would say, you know, maybe you should have thought about that and how you think the results of that have been with your family.
I can totally understand that point of view, and until somebody has walked in your shoes, there were a lot of different situations going on at the time. I was in a bad marriage. I was being mentally abused, verbally abused. I was trying to be superwoman and work and take care of three children basically on my own, and I made some bad decisions. And just because I made some bad decisions doesn't make me a bad person. And I think people need to understand that there's more than just what they see or read on the top of the surface. It mm-hmm. goes a lot deeper than that.
And that said, I mean, what do you want people to think about this issue? Because honestly, I think this isn't something that people think about. When we hear so much about the criminal justice system, we don't necessarily hear about the parent side of it, and particularly the child side of it.
Right. I think what a lot of people, when we think of a woman in prison or women in prison, they have a picture of how they portray it on TV. And that's not the reality of it. I was in there with women who were, you know, career women, had, you know, great jobs and made a bad choice. And now their children are paying the ultimate price for it by not having the relationship with their mother while they're away. And people just need to understand that in prison, things aren't the way that they seem on TV. There's not access to internet. There's not access to all this legal assistance and, you know, explaining to you what things are, and especially when it comes to guardianship or losing your parental rights, because you can be served with a paper, or the jail can be served with a paper, but that inmate, it might take them a month to 2 months to get that paper, and by the time they get it, their time to respond to it is past, and they could have lost their rights to their children before they were even given the opportunity to present their side.
Siobhan, thank you so much for sharing your story. We really appreciate it. When we come back, we're going to be speaking with a 16-year-old who takes bus trips to see her mom in prison. We'll find out more about how Illinois' budget crisis is affecting the social safety net to help these families. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st.
The 21st is made possible by Custer & Bradley, LLP, providing legal service to the Urbana-Champaign community since 1895. Custer & Bradley's attorneys are committed to achieving the best results for their clients. More information is available at CusterLawLLP.com.
You're listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. There are 186,000 children in Illinois who have a parent who is incarcerated. That number is from an Annie E. Casey Foundation report about the issue that just came out today. It says 5 million children across the country are in a similar situation. In a few minutes, we're going to be speaking with the group Voices for Illinois Children more about the report and what recommendations should be made. But as we've been talking about how families are affected, we wanted to hear from someone who has a parent in prison. Melvina is 16, and she joins us now from Chicago. Hey, Melvina, welcome to The 21st.
Hello.
Melvina, when was the last time you saw your mom?
Last time I saw my mom, I had to be like 2 months ago.
Okay. How often do you get to see her?
Every once in a while, because it's like a little bus trip, and we go out there and we see her, and we come back, and it's just like a every once in a lifetime thing. Like every once in a while, you see her.
Yeah. So is this a couple times a year?
No, it's just every once in a while. Like you see her, like basically, yeah, like a couple of times a year.
Yeah.
Canceled the bus program, so you can't even see her anymore.
Right. I know they canceled the program that was with Lutheran Social Services of Illinois. And I know we're going to talk to the folks from Claim in a minute about that bus program. But let me ask you something, Melvina. I don't know if you can describe for us, what's it like to not have your mom be a part of your daily life?
It's a harsh feeling, you know, like you gotta wake up, you don't see your mother. And you're just wondering up in your head, like you're having thoughts, like, what's going on with my mom? You know, like, is she okay? How are they treated? Because, you know, up in prison, you get treated very bad. So, like, you just got, like, thoughts going around, like, is she okay? Is she all right?
And, Melvina, I know there's been a couple times when you've gone to visit your mother and you couldn't see her because she was in solitary confinement. What happened?
When I couldn't see her?
Yeah, what did they say?
So she got up into an incident with another female for fighting, and they said that once we went down there for the bus trip, they said that we couldn't see our mom because she was up in solitary. I think it's like a band or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
solitary or something, and they said we couldn't see it because she was fighting. So,
did you know what solitary confinement was?
Yeah, it's when they lock you up in the, they told me it's when they lock you down for a whole day or so, and you can't do anything but just use the restroom, and then they give you your food every once in a while, and you can shower like 3 days a week, which is like an animal. Mm. Yeah, I know what that is.
I mean, this sounds like this is really tough on you. I mean, I wonder if you find like it's hard for you to, I mean, I wonder what you think the toughest part of it is.
The toughest part of it is just not being able to see her as much as you possibly can. I mean, like just her being in jail, period. But at the same time, the hardest outcome for me is not being able to really see her like that. Like, like it's mostly been all of my life she's been locked up. Since I was a baby, so that's 15 years of my whole life.
And you're 16.
Yeah, and I'm 16 now.
Yeah. Hey, Melvina, thanks for talking to us. I know your grandmother's with you. Can you pass the phone to her so we can talk to her for a minute?
All right.
So Barbara Mickey is with us as well, and she's been raising Melvina and her brother as well. Barbara, how long have you been raising your grandkids?
Whoa, it's been now 15 years for Melvin. And maybe a little over 15 years from now being in, like, maybe 15 years and maybe about 3 or 4 months.
Mm. And I know you have to be so much for your grandkids, right, because you're their mom and their dad. What's the biggest challenge for you in this situation?
Well, when I first got them, just to have babies, because I already had 5 other children, and Shonda is the 6th child. So to get them... You know, I got Melvina first. She was 13 months. Then 3 months later, I got Melvin. So the biggest challenge was for me, I hadn't had no baby in about 9 years. And to raise 2 babies at one time, that was a big challenge for me.
And now that they're teenagers, what's the toughest part about it?
Well, now that they're teenagers, they ask a lot of questions. And pretty much, and, you know, trying to take care of them is a little struggle here and there because, you know, they eat more now. Their clothes are much expensive, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty rough.
Barbara, you know, there's one thing I wanted to ask you about. You and I talked before we were on the air, and we were talking a lot about the system. Your daughter's in the system. You said to me before we were on the air, I wanted to share with the audience how everything you do for your kids, your grandkids, is to keep them out of the system. How do you think you can do that?
Well, I feel by their mother being locked up, and I've been, you know, talking to them, the importance of not fighting. You know, fight if you have to offend yourself, then offend yourself. But don't offend yourself in a way where you cause the body harm, because you don't know how much pressure that next person can take on their body. Mm. You know, if you get a knife or a gun, or things like that, try not to get into an altercation where it's going to be a physical altercation. Try to put things down, maybe talk about it, apologize. Mm-hmm. Pretty much whatever you have to do to keep the situation from going any farther than what is already.
Barbara Mickey, thanks for joining us. It sounds like you're doing a lot of work to take care of you. And Melvina, thanks for being with us as well. I wanted to bring a couple people back into the conversation. Alexis Manfield, let's bring her back. She's a Chicago lawyer who works specifically with incarcerated moms throughout the state. And also I wanted to bring into the conversation and introduce Leslie Helmkamp. She's a policy analyst for Voices for Illinois Children. They worked with Annie E. Casey Foundation on this report. Leslie, Alexis, thanks for being with me.
Thank you.
Alexis, let me ask you, because I wanted to bring up something Melvina brought up about the bus trips, because she said the bus trips had been cut. And I think this gets to the issue of the state and the budgets and the funding situation. How does that work with the bus trips in terms of how often kids can go down? Melvina looks like she needs to go down to, you know, she needs to go downstate to visit her mom, both Melvina and her brother. How expensive are those, and what's going on with that situation?
So there aren't a whole lot of programs that bring children to see their parents when they're incarcerated. And those programs really are crucial because children have a way of imagining the worst situation with their parents if they can't see them. I've heard a lot of kids say things to me like, I haven't been able to see my mom. She loves me. She told me that she'd do anything to be with me. And so if she's not if I'm not seeing her, if I'm not able to talk to her, then she must be dead. Or they come up with all kinds of situations based on what they see in TVs and movies about a prison. And so these phone calls really are, these bus trips are really crucial. And so they were happening once a month until December, when unfortunately Lutheran Social Services of Illinois had to cut the program due to their budget cuts. And so we have tried to restart that program here at Cabrini-Green Legal Aid together with a couple of organizations like Moms United Against Violence and Incarceration and Trinity Church Nehemiah Rising. But it is expensive. Each month costs about $3,000 just for the bus and the insurance and all the other things that are needed to bring about 55 children and their caregivers to see the moms who are in prison. But we have been raising that through some crowdfunding. We've been doing that on youcaring.com. But our goal is not to continue funding it that way. We really believe that with the state paying for incarceration and the state separating children from their parents, that the state also has a responsibility to pay for programs that keep children connected to their families and allow for long-term success. And so we're relying on the community goodwill right now, but our long-term goal is to make sure that we have community-based programs so that parents and children aren't separated and that the state pays for these programs so that children can see their parents and know that they're okay.
Leslie, what Alexis is talking about, what resources do exist right now in terms of what programs does the state fund specifically for this issue? Are there any?
Yeah, thank you. That's a very good question because I think it's really important to note that Illinois really doesn't have a broad-based system that's targeted or provides services to children of incarcerated parents. So in the correction system, we focus on sentencing, but we don't consider the children, and we don't, as a state, have that broad-based system that's informed about what children need when they are separated from their parents, both financially and emotionally. We've heard a lot about the emotional toll that it can have, and there are programs that we can invest in and prioritize to at least lessen the toll that a child suffers when they do lose a parent. But generally speaking, the state does not have this broad-based system, and those important programs that exist out there that you've just mentioned, whether or not they've received funding from the state in the past, have also been impacted by the state budget impasse generally. You know, over the years, the past several years, Illinois has cut programming, investments in programming for human services, and this has ripple effects across the support system. So even the programs that have served children that have parents that are incarcerated have been hit hard by the impasse.
Well, Leslie, even programs that maybe people wouldn't even realize may have an effect for, like, when you say that, do you mean even things like after school programs?
Yes, like the Teen Reach program has gone away. There's no funding for the Teen Reach program.
How many different programs were those throughout the state after school?
There were about 16 programs. I believe now 18 programs across the state have been cut.
And that's been in the past year because of the budget situation.
Because of the budget impasse. Mm-hmm. That's correct. Mm-hmm. And we've also seen reentry programs, those programs that sort of deal with the when a parent is released from prison. The reentry programs across the state, there have been some that have scaled back because of the budget impasse as well. So you have, you know, just general programs that a child may benefit from while their parent is in prison, and then other programs that benefit the parent to be able to help their child when they are released from prison have been cut. So we've seen many programs decimated because of the budget impasse.
The NEEKC Foundation report is a national report and includes a lot of recommendations. Given the scope of what it I wonder which ones you would highlight you think are particularly important for Illinois. There's lots of recommendations for judges, for state governments, for lawmakers. What do you think needs to be Illinois' priority when we're looking at this issue?
Well, one thing that the report pointed out was that 65% of families with a member in prison can't meet their basic needs. So they struggle to put food on the table, pay their bills, or find affordable housing. So there's a number of things that we can do to connect children and their caregivers with supports, making sure they enroll in SNAP and TANF and other programs that can help while their parent is in prison. Obviously, we can look at the programs that have been cut in the past, like the after-school programs, and really ensure that we put a trauma-informed approach to the mental health programs and mental health services out there for kids. And then finally, we really want to make sure that we preserve that connection with the parent while they're in prison. That's one of the most important things I think that also we've heard on this program today, is preserving that connection between the parent and child during that time of incarceration is so important. And that's something the state lacks. And I believe there are good programs out there that are doing it either, you know, with community support and other funding sources, but the state can really do a lot to ensure that we keep those connections together.
I wanted to ask you, Alexis, about the solitary confinement issue, because I think that's something that Melvina brought up that we don't tend to think about when inmates are in solitary confinement. I guess that means then parents also then lose contact with their kids.
They do, and with the caretakers of the children. I think another issue that we sometimes don't think about is that most of the caregivers tend to be the grandparents, at least with mothers. And so that's their daughter that they lose contact with and the person who might be helping them make decisions about school and other things. Because when someone's in solitary, they also lose access to the phone as well as contact visits, which means that if the children are able to visit, they're going to be through glass and see their parent in not a good situation, usually with chains or other types of handcuffs or shackles that not everyone wants their kids to see them like that. And so that loss of contact when someone's in solitary is just a further punishment of the family.
We just have a couple minutes left, so I want to ask both of you. Alexis, let's start with you because you're sort of on the ground in this situation. Given all of the needs we've heard and looking at the current state budget situation, what do you think should be top priorities in terms of providing these kinds of services? Alexis, what do you think?
Well, I think that the report, the Casey report, makes a lot of really good recommendations. But I think one of our first goals should be a reduction in incarceration and moving towards community-based sentencing. A lot of times, people who are sentenced to prison are sent there for things related to their mental health, drug addictions, trauma that they've experienced in the past, and it would be much easier for them to be treated in the community with their families so that they are not separated and so that children don't lose those connections. It would also be more cost efficient, and it would build people up for success, because right now when people are sent away, they have a much harder time of returning home, getting jobs, getting housing, all of the things that the report talks about. And so I would say focusing on that community-based sentencing instead of a punitive system would really help things.
Thanks so much for that. I'm afraid that's all we've got time for today, but I really want to thank Alexis Manfield. She's a supervising attorney with Chicago Legal Advocacy for Incarcerated Mothers. That's CLAIM, based at Cabrini-Green Legal Aid. I also want to thank Leslie Helmkamp, a policy analyst with Voices for Illinois Children, for joining us on this discussion. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. We tweeted out a lot of information about this. If you follow the 21st Show on Twitter, that's 21ST Show. We've got some diagrams about maps and prisons, as well as links to the entire report if you're interested in seeing it. You can also find us on Facebook. Search for the 21st Show. Stay tuned.
The 21st is made possible by the Library at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, showing and preserving significant collections and digitally archiving irreplaceable information so that it is forever accessible to students, faculty, and the community at large. The University Library at Illinois.
You're listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. A device was started Friday here in Illinois that will bring us one step closer to the power that propels the Enterprise in Star Trek. If you are wondering, that would be nuclear fusion. Nuclear fusion has been touted as the ultimate source of unlimited and cheap energy by scientists and science fiction writers, but it's always been 30 years away from commercial availability. Today, we're talking with Daniel Adrusik, a researcher from the Hydra Fusion Energy Facility at the University of Illinois. Daniel, welcome to the 21st.
Thank you. Thanks for having me, Nora.
I think we should probably start with maybe you should describe what fusion basically is for people who are not familiar.
Right. So fusion is it's a nuclear process, and it's the process that essentially drives the sun and all the stars in the universe. So it's essentially taking two light atoms, for example, isotopes of hydrogen, and you give them enough energy that when they come together, they fuse and they form a heavier atom like helium, and in the process puts out a lot of energy. So instead of splitting an atom, atoms, we're sticking them together.
Okay, and why has this always been so difficult to take this process and bring it to sort of commercial availability as an energy source?
It comes down to technology and essentially what we're trying to do. So if you think about a star and how hot a star needs to be in order to get fusion going, we have to, on Earth, we have to heat the atoms, you know, and they turn into this, what we call a plasma, which is this hot soup of ions and electrons. And we need to heat them up over 100 million degrees just in order to get the fusion reactions to happen here. And you can imagine the materials that we use to build these machines need to be able to essentially withstand this kind of power that's inside
and that kind of heat.
And that kind of heat. I mean, we use magnetic fields to trap these particles, but when you're generating the energy, the heat, it's going out to the walls. And essentially, we've been struggling to find materials that can withstand these kinds of conditions.
And is that specifically what you all are working at Hydra now?
Correct, yeah. So our lab in general for now 10 or 15 years has been working on what's called plasma material interactions. And that's just what that means is that we're looking at how do these ions and atoms that come out of the plasma, when they hit the wall, what's it actually doing? How is it, say, damaging the wall? How do the, say, particles that come off the wall then impact the performance of the plasma? And how can we, say, stop that from happening? Or what can we develop new materials that can actually withstand these kinds of conditions?
So when people say Hydra, of course, I think everyone immediately, I didn't help by throwing a Star Trek reference in there, right? Because I think everyone thinks, is this a big thing? I mean, what does it look like? Is this just, this is a facility where everything's happening, but is this all happening at a level that's so microscopic you can't even see it?
No. This is a 72-ton machine. 72 metric tons.
So what does it look like? Can you see what's happening inside?
You can, yeah. We've got cameras that point inside the machine that give you a view, and you can see the plasma going around. It's basically a large donut.
Okay.
So in terms of its overall dimensions, it's about 2.5 meters in diameter. It's probably a good maybe 3 meters high. So it's a... In our world, it's considered a medium-sized machine.
And how does what you're working on fit into this field of nuclear fusion in terms of bringing
right.
this to availability?
So we're actually looking at a new way of, or a new type of material to use in a fusion device. And we're looking at liquid metals and liquid lithium. Turns out liquid lithium has a lot of very good properties in that because it's a liquid, it's not as susceptible to the damage that you might get. It can absorb heat, take it away, and you can then replace with new liquid metal. And it also has a very interesting effect that it cleans up the plasma and the vacuum vessel. So any impurities that we have in there, we pull out. And it turns out that it's the impurities that make a lot of problems for us and that have really kept us from getting...
So I'm going to ask the journalist anywhere. Question that I bet scientists probably hate, but do you have a time frame for when you know that perhaps we will be closer? Are we still 30 years away from this being a great source of clean energy?
That's a very difficult question, but I'll put it into perspective. We've just had W7X in Germany come online. And actually, our machine was the predecessor to that machine because we got it from that lab. And we're building ITER, which is essentially going to be the first demonstration of power where we get more power out than we put in. So we won't be actually putting electricity into the grid, but we still have that power coming out. That machine will come online in about 10 to 12 years. And already they're planning on the first prototype power station called Demo. And that's probably 30 years away.
Okay. Yeah. So we still are. Okay. Well, that's not bad. All right. Well, thank you so much for joining us. This is Daniel Andruzic. He teaches in the Department of Nuclear, Plasma, and Radiological Engineering at the University of Illinois. Thanks, Daniel.
Thank you very much.
You're listening to The 21st. $600 million will soon start flowing to Illinois colleges and universities. The comptroller says she'll start processing checks immediately. This morning, the governor signed last Friday's compromise bill into law just about an hour and a half ago. It's the first state money campuses will see in almost 10 months, and administrators say they're happy to have it. But this is only a short-term solution. University of Illinois President Timothy Killeen was quick to call the deal, which includes the largest single cut in state funding for higher education, insufficient. What about other university presidents? Western Illinois has already had significant cuts and layoffs. Its president, Jack Thomas, joins us now by phone from his office in Macomb. President Thomas, welcome to the 21st.
Thank you.
Thanks for making time to do this. I know right now Western's in a situation where you have already dipped into your reserves. The campuses announced more than 100 layoffs before this funding was announced. What are you telling students and faculty now about what this funding will mean for your campus?
We're telling students, as we've always told them, that we will be open, and we've been here 117 years. We'll be here 117 more years and beyond. This is a stopgap, and we're very pleased that we have gotten funding as a stopgap to keep us moving into the fall semester. And we continue to register students, and we continue to provide a quality and well-rounded education. We are excited about this stopgap.
You're excited about a stopgap. I think that's, but in terms of beyond that, let's start with the stopgap first, right? Because you all are going to see just under $15 million from this, another $5 million for MAP grants for students, and that's it for the rest of the fiscal year. And I know that last year there were $50 million in state funds. So how much of this stopgap is too little too late?
Well, as I said, we're pleased that we did get the stopgap, but you have to take in consideration that we haven't had a budget in 10 months, and this budget impasse has been going on for 10 months, and we had a reserve in place that we've utilized that reserve, and we've had reductions since 2002. So at this point, anything will help, but as we said, I was there on Thursday and Friday. When the legislators were meeting, one thing that they did say that this is a stopgap, and that's what we're holding them to, that it's a stopgap. We're looking forward to a full budget at some point soon. And the presidents and chancellors we've met of the public institutions, we're saying the same thing. We'll continue to advocate for a full budget. And all of the legislators that I've talked to, and even the governor, everybody understands that this is a stopgap. And we're looking forward to a full-funded budget for all of us and to show that the legislators and the governor that they support higher education. We can no longer not fund higher education.
President Thomas, I know on Thursday night you were referencing Springfield, and I know on Thursday night you were understandably frustrated when a lot of people thought that there was going to be a deal and that fell through, came together on Friday morning. I have to ask, when you're having conversations with the governor and with other lawmakers, how frustrated, how open do you feel like you can be with them about your frustration?
I think I can be as open as possible because, you know, when we mention and when I've mentioned the challenges and all the things that we are experiencing here at Western and in higher education in general, and I speak not just for Western but for my colleagues at other colleges and universities as well, they say that they understand. When I testified before the Senate, they asked me did I have anything else to say, and I said yes. You all say you understand the pain, you understand the reductions and how challenging it is. We've had layoffs, we had furloughs, We reduced over the years, and we continue to do that. They say they understand our frustration. And I said, if you understand our frustrations, why don't you invest in higher education?
And what's their response?
Well, they said that they have to come to an agreement, and both sides really have to come together. And we've seen what they can do, because this Friday they did come together. And we do see a difference in Springfield right now. So we're happy with what's happening in Springfield, that they are coming to an agreement that they have, and that they will continue to agree on things about a future budget.
That's what I was going to ask, President Thomas. Certainly we heard Governor Rauner say today that he hopes that this is now a place to build upon for bipartisan reform. Do you have a sense that things have changed, or do you fear that this is just something that postpones further inaction by lawmakers?
Well, I hope that something has changed. And they see the damage that has been caused to higher education, and that damage is going to take some time to repair, because we're in a state of, as we say, a crisis of confidence. Individuals do not have confidence in the support that we're getting for higher education. That's when you're recruiting students. You hear it from students. You hear it from prospective students as well as parents. And when you look at higher education outside of the state of Illinois, they're all looking at us and saying, what are you doing? Do you all really value higher education? We're the second largest exporter of students from high schools. When students graduate, they go to other states. So in order to make education more affordable, we're going governor and the legislators are going to have to fund higher education more so than what they've done in the past. Since 2002, we've had reduction after reduction. And then this year, not even having a state-appropriated budget really make things tough for all of us in higher education.
Well, that crisis of confidence you're speaking about, President Thomas, I wanted to ask, how do the numbers of students accepting enrollment offers for the fall right now, how does that compare for UAlk to last year?
Well, we do have, we do see some shortfalls there in where we were last year. I don't have those specific numbers.
Do you have a sense of it? Is it a significant shortfall?
Well, it's kind of difficult to tell right now, but yes, even from fall to spring, we had a reduction. And if you look at most of our institutions, we're all seeing that shortfall, basically, in our enrollment.
And do you said, is the amount of funding that you've received on Friday, does that affect any of the layoffs or furloughs or plan cuts, or do those have to go forward?
Well, because we have depleted many of our funds, we still have to go forth with the layoffs and other reductions. But at some point, we hope to bring some of those individuals back at some point, basically, particularly once we see what is happening coming out of Springfield in terms of providing funding, more funding for us.
That is President of Western Illinois University, Jack Thomas. Unfortunately, we're almost out of time because it's the end of the hour. President Thomas, can I ask you to stick around? Do you have a few minutes? And we'll record some of it and then we'll put it online. Do you have a few minutes to do that?
Sure.
Okay, great. Thank you so much. I appreciate it. I know this is a very busy time for you. That's Jack Thomas. He's the president of Western Illinois University. And as I said, after the show, once we're off air, I'm going to continue to talk to him. We'll put that online. If you follow us on Facebook, search for The 21st Show. Also, you can find us on Twitter. It's 21STShow. We'll tweet that out. And we'll also possibly put some of that up on our actual radio airwaves as well. So that does it for us today. Thanks for listening to The 21st. And we've got special music today. It's to cheer on the Blackhawks. Big Game 7 tonight against the St. Louis Blues. The puck drops at 7:40. Let's go Blackhawks. That's our show for today. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Thanks for listening to The 21st. And go Hawks!
shell. Oh yeah. Someone said she was asking out to me, but I know you best as a blagger. I said, tell me your name, is it sweet? She said, my boy is a dagger.